Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. Good afternoon. You're listening to KYRS. You're also listening to Praxis. I'm your host, Taylor, and you might be having deja vu right now. I'm returning to my show after a long hiatus since February 2017. So I'm back on the air. This is my new time slot, Mondays at 4 p.m. You can expect to hear it's a public affairs show. I mostly do interviews. I have a great interview lined up for you today, all about, as the name might suggest, Praxis, how we make change, talking about social change theory, some politics stuff. Interviews with academics, artists, activists, organizers, and the like. So welcome. If it's your first time listening to the show, welcome back if you're an old-time listener. I have a great interview lined up that I did this past Saturday with Dr. Joan Braun. And without too much ado, I'm going to dive right into that. If you have any suggestions for the show, interview ideas, questions, you can always email me at praxis, P-R-A-X-I-S, at kyrs.org. I also run a podcast, so if you're in the car and you miss part of the show, you can catch it later. There's a link on our website at kyrs.org. You can also go directly to soundcloud.com/praxisradio. So, yeah, without further ado, I'm going to turn us over to that interview with Joan Braun. So happy to be back, and look forward to many more shows this fall, winter, and spring. All right, so I'm here in the studio with Dr. Joan Braun, and we are going to talk a little bit about fascism and whatever else comes up. So, hi.
Hi.
Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Can you just start by introducing yourself and just talking a little bit about your background and how you came to know so much about fascism?
Sure. So I grew up in kind of an activist family. I've always been involved in social justice work in various capacities. I've been in Spokane for 2 years, and I moved up here shortly before the election. So after Trump was elected, I started to realize that something had shifted in the political landscape. And it really happened when I saw this neo-Nazi, whom a lot of people have heard of, Richard Spencer, who got punched at the inauguration and is also famous for giving a kind of Sieg Heil salute to Trump after the election, getting just a bunch of free airtime. And he was all over NPR and CNN. And at that point, I realized that something had shifted in terms of what was potentially considered normal in the political landscape. So I underwent a project where I tried to figure out the influence of fascist ideology on the Trump administration, as well as hate groups nationally.
Great. So it's been I guess a long, almost 2 years since
yes.
then. And I guess if we can start, I think there's a renewed conversation around this in general because of the political tenor of the time. But I think there's still some pretty common misconception around some of these ideas. So I guess starting at the basic building block, what is fascism as a concise definition?
Right. Now, it's a little tough because scholars don't really agree on a single definition of fascism. But what we want to do, I think, is exclude certain simplifications, for sure. So one misconception, for example, is that any censorship of speech is automatically fascism. And while it's true that fascist states like Hitler and Mussolini's Germany and Italy did engage in censorship, lots of other totalitarian states have done that. Fascism is a specific political ideology, and it's essentially a way of justifying violence and exclusion toward scapegoated groups that are blamed unfairly for economic decline and a sense of meaninglessness or cultural upheaval in a society. And so that can take a variety of different forms, but I would say a pretty essential part of that belief system is that human beings are fundamentally unequal and that society should be established in such a way as to give those who are more worthy of power more power. And that's often divided along lines of race and gender as well as other categories.
Yeah, and you know, when you talk about that scapegoating and everything, we obviously in this country have a long, rich history of a lot of that behavior. What do you think sets this administration and this moment apart in terms of a deepening of that commitment? And like, is there a formalization happening?
Right. That's a great question. And it's hard to divide because we do have such a strong history of white supremacy and genocide in this country. So is Donald Trump just, you know, a new like Andrew Jackson? I mean, that's a possible answer. Steve Bannon seems to think there's some similarity between the two. So it's not the first time we've had populists that have empowered racists in positions of power in this country, of course. But I think because of the economic crisis and because of a lot of things that are happening globally, there's an attempt to blame others, especially because of increased migration that is giving people sort of an easy scapegoat for thinking about what is really just a failure of capitalism and how it can be explained through blaming somebody more easily.
Yeah. So, and you mentioned this as kind of a global phenomenon also. Right. I want to mostly focus on this country, but can you speak to that a tiny bit, just how the U.S. fits into this larger global moment?
Yeah. So sadly, we've seen in elections across Europe a resurgence of political parties that have historic ties to Nazism. And we've seen this just most recently in Sweden, just a couple of weeks ago. We've seen it in France with the resurgence of Marine Le Pen, in Denmark, in the Netherlands, basically just across Europe. Brexit in the United Kingdom, even though it was, for a lot of people, just an economic policy kind of vote, for a lot of people, that was a vote for xenophobia and nationalism. So we're really seeing this globally. And it's also... it's not even just confined to Europe. Like if you look at Hindu nationalism in India, or there's an election coming up in Brazil where fascists are rooting for a particular candidate. The president of the Philippines has called himself a fascist fairly recently. So it is a really international problem.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of these figures are figures that Donald Trump has publicly, you know, applauded and
absolutely
held up as examples,
right?
Particularly in the Philippines.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And across Europe. So that's...
Yeah.
Really great.
There's a genocide going on in the Philippines where you have people that are just being accused of being drug dealers and or drug users and killed without any due process. And Trump has said that he really admires the way the Philippines is fighting the drug war.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So that's horrific,
yes.
Obviously. And, you know, this has the potential to go that way as a topic. Where do you think we're at in the U.S. in terms of our preparation level to understand and ultimately to combat nascent fascism?
On a certain level, it's really bad because people don't understand ideologically at all what they're dealing with. They don't understand the belief system. They're very easily fooled by all kinds of things. So when fascists call themselves simply defenders of free speech or simply trolls who are trying to get people to debate things more freely, people often fall for that. I think, on the other hand, especially here in the Northwest, we've seen the impact of this ideology before, and the history of the Aryan Nations is very foremost in people's memory here, and every community in this country has gone through these kinds of struggles. So there is a very strong current of anti-racist sentiment at the same time in the United States, and there's also a strong sense that we are a country of immigrants, which not every country shares. So I think because of the history of the civil rights movement, because of how far we've come, there is quite a bit of momentum to push back. But people need to know what they're looking at.
Mm-hmm. And how has that gone for you, just in terms of being sort of locally, you know, an emerging person who is presenting these ideas to the public? What do you think the public reaction is in general to someone saying, hey, watch out, we've got legitimate fascism coming our way?
Most people, I think, are concerned, but it does take a little bit of doing to help people see what's actually happening. Because if it's not impacting your world, it's very easy to think that people are just being alarmists, or to be confused and think that people are just trying to whip up sentiment against Trump and sort of manufacturing something that doesn't exist. But these groups are active in our own community. In fact, we look at Identity Europa, for example, which is a fascist organization, and they've put up flyers all over this town, at the community colleges, at Gonzaga University, downtown. They've done banner drops. They're quite active.
Mm-hmm. At Eastern and Cheney as well.
Yeah. And in fact, one of their members, James Alsup, and we may get into this more later, has spoken with publicly with local Republican leaders. So this is not even just a fringe phenomenon anymore. It's striving for normalization, so to speak. It wants to get into public institutions and become part of the normal political spectrum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and yeah, let's jump into talking about that strategy. So I know for me, the first time I heard about James Alsup as a character, he was still head of the WSU College Republicans down in Pullman, and they had put together an action in which they built a, I think, 20-foot tall wall on the campus, on which they were chanting, "Build that wall." They were behaving in really threatening ways toward students they perceived as being undocumented or perceived as even just being non-white, doing some really intimidating things on campus. So that's where my introduction to James Alsup comes. Do you want to build on that and talk about kind of how we got to this place we got to a month or so ago?
Sure. James Alsup had positions of some degree of leadership within the Republican Party in Washington State. He was the statewide chair of the College Republicans for the state of Washington. He was, as you mentioned, the president of his chapter of the College Republicans at WSU. He was also on the board of leadership for Students for Trump. And when Trump came to Washington as a candidate, Alsup was one of those introducing Trump to the crowd. So he was very much within the political establishment to a certain extent. And I think he probably still has somewhere a rather massive email list and list of contacts from all of his time in those leadership positions. And what happened was, it's hard to trace exactly at what point, but he grew increasingly extremist in his views, or increasingly public at any rate about his extremist ideology. In the summer after Trump's election, he participated in a number of rallies with fascists. He went to Washington, D.C., for example, in June. This was before the famous Charlottesville March in 2017. And there were two rallies that day in D.C. for free speech. It was originally going to be sort of a general alt-right and alt-light, sort of fascists and fascist-affiliated people were going to rally for free speech, so to speak. They're not really for free speech. We can come back to that. But they were having this free speech rally, so-called. And there was a split because not all of them decided they wanted to actually rally with the Nazis. So there was one rally that included Richard Spencer and neo-Nazis and one that did not. And Alsup was a speaker at the one with the Nazis. So that was even before Charlottesville. And then, of course, in August of 2017, there was this horrific and violent torchlit march with KKK members and neo-Nazis and others in Charlottesville. And Alsup was a participant in that march, which he's very proud of. In fact, he said the only thing he regrets about participating in Charlottesville was that he didn't hold a tiki torch.
Ooh.
Yeah. So after he returned from Charlottesville, he was exiled in some sense from the formal Republican establishment. They had to do that for their own reputation and safety. But he's maintained certain connections, clearly. And this summer, in July, he was a speaker at an organization called Northwest Grassroots. And Northwest Grassroots has a variety of different political persuasions, you might say. It's clearly on what I would call the far right. It's given platforms to people affiliated with the John Birch Society, kind of neo-Confederate pastors, Christian Identity pastor at a certain point, or I don't know if he would call himself Christian Identity, but sort of racist pastor, Islamophobic bigots. They've given a lot of space to far-right ideology. But this is probably the most in-your-face kind of extremist that they have invited. They had him in July They did not announce previously that he was going to be a speaker, but afterwards they were very public about it. They put it on Facebook and Twitter, a full video of this event at which James Alsup had spoken alongside various local public officials. And following the revelation that that had occurred, the chair of the Spokane County Republican Party, Cecily Wright, stepped down from her position as chair of the Republican Party of Spokane due to pressure around this this whole thing, because she was the leader of Northwest, or one, the co-leader of Northwest Grassroots, co-founder with her husband, and she had introduced Alsup at the event, at which she said that he had been quote-unquote label lynched, that calling him a white supremacist had been unfair, and that it was akin to lynching. A rather troubling comparison.
Mm-hmm. Particularly considering that he is open about his views by being a member of Identity Europa, which is explicitly, its mission is explicitly connected to the supremacy of the quote-unquote white race.
Yes.
Yeah. And
they're very good at cloaking that, but that is what they're about.
Yeah. Part of my recollection of what happened with Cecily Wright is that she and many other formal GOP leaders had already denounced Alsup at the time that he was elected as a PCO, a precinct committee officer for the GOP. And then they kind of doubled back and said they had no idea who this young man truly was, mere months after having denounced the same person.
It was very ironic and interesting. Cecily, in fact, had told the Inlander local paper just, I think, a few weeks before this whole thing that she wanted to punch James Alsup in the face. So she had positioned herself as this opponent of him, had publicly denounced him on behalf of her position as chair of the county Republicans. So she knew exactly what she was doing, in the sense that she knew his affiliation or public perception of him, and had been willing to speak out against him, and backtracked and invited him and celebrated him, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so how does, and there were other, I know that there's kind of an ongoing conversation around this, because there were other elected officials in the room who at the very least did not stand up and say, excuse me, we find your views intolerable and we're upset that you're here, when they had the chance. There's an open Q&A on film at the end of the event in which none of these leaders said anything. I guess we can speak to that, but also, how does this entryist strategy play out across the board? My understanding is that James Alsup's not alone in attempting to kind of infiltrate the GOP as a strategy.
Right. So there were other people in that room, including Rob Chase, who's county treasurer, and Rod Higgins, who's the mayor of Spokane Valley, and we have yet to get a kind of proper apology from them. There's been an effort to get a statement made on behalf of the Spokane Valley City Council denouncing white nationalism, and there's been some motion and progress on that after a series of meetings and a series of people testifying, so I'm hopeful that the Spokane Valley City Council will do that, which is hopefully kind of an easy, minimal action. But about entryism, this is a really wonderful term, and it's a really important concept in terms of what's happening right now. What the fascist movement is doing, well, it's divided, because you do have some people that are just more engaged in terrorism, essentially, like Adam Waffen, which just has been involved in several murders over the past year or so. But what Identity Europa is trying to do, what Alsup's organization is trying to do, is to put kind of a friendly, well-dressed, college student kind of face on fascism. They don't use a swastika. They use a cute little green triangle. They've remodeled their image. And this is not new. This has been going on since the 80s. So if you talk to people who have left these movements behind, if you talk to people in organizations like Life After Hate, who were in skinhead movements in the 80s and 90s, they remember conversations about how they were going to remodel their image and, you know, drop the swastikas, go to college, blend in, mainstream the ideology. And that's essentially what's happening. Now, within Identity Europa, there's a lot of this talk, very publicly on their podcasts and so on, about taking over mainstream institutions, and especially the Republican Party. So James Alsup has said, for example, that if you use what Trump is actually saying, you can quote Trump himself to people, and that can be an entry point into spreading white nationalist ideology. He is a precinct committee officer, which is a very easy position to get. No one ran against him. No one was paying attention to him running. And he thinks that's a strategy that could work nationally. He's talked about getting people, college students, young people who share a fascist ideology, to just show up to a few Republican meetings. And if you wear a suit and tie, if you look good, if you make a good impression, he says people will just give you a leadership position without you even trying. And so you can take over at the grassroots level and start shaping policy, start choosing which candidates are selected, and so on. And this is happening across a variety of organizations. And it's not simply the Republican Party, even though the Republican Party has made itself particularly accessible because of Trump and because of various statements that they've tolerated. They're particularly accessible to entryism, but there have even been some entryist attempts into the Democratic Party over the past year or so as well, with the Traditionalist Workers Party, for example, trying to network with Democrats. And now we just had this guy in town this past week, this anti-Semitic conspiracy theorist, Patrick Little, claims he's running for president on a Democratic Party ticket. So it's not so much about which party, it's a strategy of entering and taking over something that's mainstream, something that appears normal.
Wow. Yeah. Thank you. That's a really succinct summary of that really wild strategy and reality that we're living in. So if you're just joining us, I'm talking with Dr. Joan Braun about fascism in general, kind of what this newest wave looks like locally and across the country. So let's talk. I mean, you just alluded to it, but I think it's really important that people understand what the map looks like in terms of who these groups are, who these actors are, and how they vary from each other, but how they all are kind of contributing to this wave. So, yeah, can you speak to that a little bit in terms of kind of who the major players are and where they land on a scale of nonviolent to violent, sure, explicit to coded?
Right. So there are so many of these organizations, but I would say Identity Europa, I think, is one of the most important to watch because they're very good at this rebranding thing. On the other hand, you also have the Traditionalist Workers Party has crumbled to some extent, but they had a model that was a little bit more explicitly fascist in terms of sharing the main points of their ideology with people, but they were trying to sort of pass themselves off, which is a common thing within fascist ideology, as sort of in solidarity with the workers, right, and the white working class, right? And there is, of course, no white working class. There's just the working class. Mm-hmm. But they had this idea that what you could do is you tap into that anger, just like Trump did with his election. So you tap into the alienation and anger of white people, especially in these Rust Belt kind of regions or coal country kind of regions, which, by the way, it's not working very well for them. I think they misunderstand the working class in a really deep way. But that's one strategy also. So they're a little bit more rough around the edges and a little bit less like college student appearance. There are a number of organizations that try that approach. And then you also have, I think we want to think about hate groups broadly to include things that maybe don't explicitly share fascist ideology, but that give cover and credence to those beliefs by socializing with those people, by holding up the same slogans. So we think about things like the Proud Boys, for example. And the Proud Boys are considered a hate group. They're not explicitly white nationalist, but they see themselves as fighting the left. One of their slogans is fighting solves everything. And what they try to do essentially is go into left-wing communities, left-wing protests, and stir up violence, and then claim to be persecuted and claim that they are mistreated by left-wing protesters. So they're trying to create this whole narrative. And then, of course, you have more traditional, easier to recognize fascists of various stripes. You have things like the National Socialist Movement, or the Daily Stormer. And these organizations, there's quite a bit of conversation that happens across the lines of these various kinds of groups. There is overlap. These people may not see themselves as believing exactly the same thing, but they're willing to talk to one another in many cases.
Do you think that that's a strategic advantage that they might... do you think there's anything we can learn from that on the left?
You know, I think they're stealing from us, to be honest. So I think we have probably better unity on the left than the right does. They're striving to have the kind of unity that we have on the left, but I don't think they're achieving it. I could talk a little bit more about some other things that I think they're stealing from the left.
Yeah, go for it.
So one of the things that's particularly interesting to me is the way the far right is appropriating the ideas of Antonio Gramsci, who is very much part of the tradition of the left. And if you look back at the history of the left, think back to the Black Panthers in the 1960s, for example, the point at which the FBI really freaked out about the influence of the Black Panthers was not at the point at which they were carrying guns, but the point at which they were offering free breakfast to children. And the Panthers realized that you don't reach people simply through ideology, that you have to reach people through service and community building and belonging. And the fascists have picked up on this idea that the left and Marxists have often, you know, followed. And they've tried it, you know, locally on a very small scale, and nationally, groups like Identity Europa in particular are trying to do these sort of small charity projects. And they'll talk about how it's optics, how it's just about branding, but it's more than that, because they know what they're doing is they're trying to reach people that are alienated and angry. But instead of reaching them with the message that justice is possible and a better society can be built, they're reaching them with the message that you can expel your rage onto others and feel better by picking on someone beneath you on the social ladder. And if you look at the far right in Europe, which the far right in the U.S. is constantly appropriating from, the far right in Europe is also appropriating these ideas from the left. So if you look at Casa Pound, for example, in Italy, this is a traditional fascist group in Rome, and they have a hostel where you can stay. If you are, you know, white and Italian and so on and not an immigrant, they have a free clinic where you can get, you know, a heart checkup if you are a white Italian and so forth. And these are all very small-scale things, but that's part of the direction that the right is going in. And it's important that we know that because we don't want to cede that ground to them. So we want to be thinking about our own ways of building community and of serving.
And I can see how that ties in really in a, unfortunately, in an elegant way, almost to more mainstream conservative policy around privatization and...
Oh, interesting.
And things like that.
Yes, you know? Right. You don't need the government. Your local fascists will feed you if you belong to the right category.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I want to double back again to something that you alluded to that I think is really at the crux of public perception around this issue, which is the issue of free speech.
Yes.
Which these fascist folks have really, really glommed onto and raised as their main banner, I think. In the world, particularly around, you know, I think the most recent touchstone people are probably familiar with is the removal of Alex Jones InfoWars from, I think, every major social media platform at this point. So, can you speak to the idea of free speech in general and maybe to that deplatforming that's happened more specifically?
Yeah. So some of this kind of outraged pearl clutching by the fascists is clearly just... an act. They don't believe in free speech for everyone. That's not the objective of the society they're trying to construct. They need free speech tactically so that they're able to advance ideas that ultimately undermine free speech and ultimately undermine all kinds of freedoms. But one of the things that I think is interesting to think about is the First Amendment to the Constitution prohibits the curtailment of speech by the government. But it doesn't mean that individuals have to welcome fascists into their social circles or give them platforms or invite them to speak on campuses. And certainly private entities like YouTube and Twitter are going to be able to make their own decisions legally about whose views they want to air. And I think the deeper question also is, are there some things, and I don't know, actually, I've thought about this, and I'm still thinking about this, but I think it's possible that there are some views that you do want to, that do actually undermine the whole project of democracy and free speech, that if you air certain particular kinds of views, you're undermining the entire project that makes free speech possible. And you want to have a rather narrow definition of what those things are, but it's also important to keep in mind that some of the things that are being brought forward as simply speech and simply another view are actually deeply threatening to communities and are in many cases just veiled threats. So when somebody puts up a swastika, they're not actually just advancing a view. To many people in the community, that is a death threat. So there are a lot of things to consider there.
Mm-hmm. And that's something I've considered as well, you know, because in the wrong hands, Facebook notoriously also shadow bans. They have a practice referred to as shadow banning, and it has been documented as disproportionately affecting Black activists in the Black Lives Matter movement, particularly when they call out the racism of Facebook's practices. So, you know, I think that there is a very legitimate conversation to be had around what is the role of these powerful companies in monitoring and controlling speech. But as you said, you know, that line where it's a threat, where it's if your point of view is that entire groups of humans should not have the right to exist on the earth, then that's more than a difference of opinion.
Yeah, and I think the debate around free speech in this country has just gotten so abstract, because we have to look at individual cases, I think, when we talk about this kind of thing. And there have certainly been measures that have censored people unreasonably. Google, in the way that it has decided which things to frontline, has impacted the left as well as the right in sidelining particular views. And those things are all important to think about, but I think at a certain point the law or principles just get so abstract and we don't think about individual cases. So when someone is saying something offensive about a targeted group, for example, it's different from someone just complaining about how annoying white people are. And those things may in the abstract seem the same if you just take out white and put in black, but it is different because of the context that we're in.
Sure, and that seems to be at the heart of a lot of this, because it's hard to believe when you hear some of the ideology that these people are espousing that you're living in the same reality at all. And how do you think we can address that problem? I mean, as a philosopher by background, how do you think we can address just the reality problem that's at play?
Right. And I think a lot of this comes back to what I was talking about in terms of building community and not ceding that ground to the right. So people that are looking for identity and belonging and purpose need to be able to find that on the left, or, you know, just simply among people that respect the basic dignity of all people. And they should not have to find that on the far right. So part of this is about creating cultures and spaces where people have a way to belong and have a way to have meaning. Once people are actually in that ideology, you can't debate them. It takes experts, it takes therapy to get them out. And there are organizations that do that. But I think for the average person, the average activist, the best way to deal with this, honestly, is to protect yourself and your community first. There's a wonderful new book that I haven't started reading, but I've spoken with the author, and I'm just getting it in the mail, hopefully today, called Empowered Boundaries, by Christian Storm. And Christian Storm is a therapist as well as sort of a activist against white nationalism. She helped to found something in Seattle decades ago called, it was like a self-defense group following the death of someone who was killed by skinheads in Seattle. And her thesis is that people don't have a proper sense of boundaries on the personal level. And because of that, they're allowing too much space for fascists. So they're saying, oh, maybe I have, maybe I have to let this person into my coffee shop. Maybe I have to let this person into my bar. Maybe I'm being mean if I report them for bullying or for violence. And I think for women especially, it's hard because we're socialized to accept and to make space and to show compassion. And sometimes the compassionate thing to do is to draw a line and to say, your ideas are not acceptable within public society because mm-hmm. you're going to put people in danger.
Mm-hmm. And I've seen that as the kind of the primary debate on even beyond the general left, but in society at large, mainstream dialogue, that is the main divide is should we talk to these people at all or not? And as you said, I mean, I've been personally as a member of the media, as someone who's done this work, I've been appalled to see Richard Spencer on NPR, to see these people being given a platform, because in some ways they can't lose when they have a platform, because if you treat them reasonably, they get a platform for their views to a general audience, and if you use the interaction as an opportunity to critique their worldview, they really well, I think, appropriate the language of bullying and discrimination to say, look how mean they were to us. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There are some situations where I think this has worked, but it's so rare. There was one particularly good piece that was done by the Guardian that was filmed, where the guy really took Richard Spencer to task. But I think so much the reporting, the problem is that we're letting these people speak for themselves. And when Identity Europa says, for example, we just want a white majority United States, we're just against immigration, you have to explain what that's coming from and what the ideology is, and not just let them run this scam, essentially. So tell me more about that. What were you... So...
Yeah, I mean, I just think that that's a major question for us all, and I think that the boundaries framework is a really useful one, you know, particularly someone who is, you know, socialized in girl land to be nice, you know.
Right.
I think we all have this embedded niceness that has really been taken advantage of in these situations.
Yeah, that's really true. And I think, so it's also, it's like one thing if it's like your racist uncle, it's another thing if it's Richard Spencer. So there are situations where you can talk to someone and make some kind of headway, but that can't be equated with giving people a microphone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like uncles get the real brunt.
Poor uncles.
That's the issue. That's the example I constantly hear and use myself. It's your racist uncle at Thanksgiving. Yeah, I have some great uncles who are not super racist. But yeah, if you're just joining us, I'm talking here on Praxis with Dr. Joan Braun about the emergence of fascism in the U.S., the kind of prominence of this ideology in our current society and what we can do about it. So what have I not asked about so far that you think is important for folks to know when they're approaching this topic?
Well, I think it's interesting to think about how recruitment into these organizations operates. So a lot of this has shifted online, and young people in particular are being targeted. So I think there's a misconception, or a lot of misconceptions, about how people get engaged in this ideology. For some, it's through social media and through memes and through kind of bringing people in with things that appear to be a joke at first and then provide people with a sense of community and a sense of meaning and an outlet for their anger and then sort of suck them into the organization that way. That's become a really prominent means of recruiting. There's also recruitment at cultural fairs and in subcultures, whether it's, you know, Renaissance fairs or video games. So it's interesting and important to pay attention to what you can do within the subcultures you belong to. Can you make your subculture, whatever that might be, if you're into comic books or film or whatever, can you use that as a way to talk about ending racism and, you know, working for social justice within your subculture? I think it's super important, too, for families to be talking to young people about what they're seeing on the internet, because oftentimes things begin as a joke and then lead to ideological recruitment.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think are some of the, I don't know, I guess this is going to start sounding like a pamphlet, but just talking about prevention, you know, what are some of the things that parents specifically can look for?
I think just talking to your kids is so important. There's no clear warning sign. It's a little different from like gang involvement, for example, where the member of the gang will identify with the gang and wear the gang colors. And I think schools struggle with this because they're used to that kind of model. So they're looking for, they're hoping we can give them a list of symbols or something. And it's true, there are symbols. I mean, you can look online, you know, find out what Identity Ropa's triangle looks like or something. But it's not the sort of flashing of symbols or slogans. It's where are people getting their sense of belonging? And where are they finding themselves in the world? And how are they viewing the world? And those are just conversations that have to be had. And if people are not already over the brink, they should be engaged in the community in a way where they're coming into positive contact with all different kinds of people and not secluding themselves on the internet or in some very small cultural world trying to find meaning with people that are also angry and alienated.
Yeah, and that kind of reminds me, I wanted to talk about the role of the troll in this movement, because that's been very interesting to me. And just this last week, there's been an online debate I've been witnessing around whether or not the you know, the OK symbol, linking your index finger with your thumb, I have to describe it for radio listeners, leaving your other three fingers up, whether that's officially a white power gesture at this point or not. There's been some instances of prominent people flashing it on television, in photographs, and now they're saying, oh, that's just a troll thing. That's a joke that you guys don't understand. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, it's not just a joke. And I find that that's often the defense it's the defense of every bully, right? Every bully who calls you a racial slur or calls you ugly or tries to harm you will always say, oh, I'm just joking. And it's part of that is just the mentality of the bully. But the thing with the so-called white power symbol, it plays in different ways. So it became a thing because it was a gesture that Trump in particular does when he speaks. And aside from him being Trump, it's not independently a symbol of white power. But because of that, it was put out initially as a kind of joke, but as a kind of tactic by white supremacists on the internet who decided to remodel this as a symbol of white power. And so when people flash this symbol, I think they know, if they're doing it for like a photo, for example, and not just not knowing what it is, but intentionally posing with this symbol, they know that it's going to offend people. They're doing it in a bullying kind of way. They're doing it intentionally to offend and to harm people. And depending on their level of knowledge, they may be doing it to offend people as a clear racist symbol, or they might be doing it just to offend people by being really in your face about their support for Trump. But I think when something is a joke symbol for racism, at that point, it's not a joke. It's a symbol for racism. Just like people will say, oh, the Confederate flag is just my heritage. And it's like, well, do you know the impact that it has on African Americans when they mm-hmm. pass into your city and they see that? And if you do know, then it's not just about your heritage. Mm-hmm. And you know that it's impacting people.
Yeah. And seeing it as frequently as I do in Spokane and North Idaho, the heritage argument is hard to make from 2,000 miles away.
Yes.
So, yes. I was also hoping to ask you a little bit about how can people, if people are hearing this and maybe it's new information for them, or if it's not new information, but they're really ready to do something. And as you said, that antidote is getting involved. What are some local and national opportunities for people to be involved in countering fascism?
Yeah, and I think, so on the local level, it's about supporting communities that are already doing this work. There are so many organizations doing good social justice work in Spokane. Spokane Community Against Racism, or SCAR, the NAACP, Families Against Bigotry, which was formed to deal with the situation of recruitment in high schools, the Peace and Justice Action League of Spokane. I'm in Spokane Democratic Socialists of America as well. We have a new committee devoted to working on opposition to fascism. Oh, one thought about that, if I may. I don't know how we're doing on time.
No, we're great.
One of those statements that we made in that document as we were coming together and thinking strategically as socialists, how do we fight fascism, is we wanted people to understand that fascism is not simply a crime problem that can be fixed with law enforcement, and it's not simply a problem of one capitalist political party that can be fixed with elections. So we're dealing with an actual social movement that's going to continue to exist for some time, and we need to fight it with mass protest and mass organizing, and not think that it's going to go away if somebody just comes along and saves us, whether that's police or politicians. So anyway, that just leads into this broader, you know, theme of finding out where in your community you can go to support people and work with people that are doing this work. And there are so many good organizations out there doing that.
Yeah. And I'll be sure to throw some links in with the notes on the podcast and on the show. We have a few minutes left, and I want to come back. You reminded me of something very important I wanted to ask, which is about the role of the state in working on this issue, because we've seen some very disappointing and scary things this past summer. Looking at Portland, when the Proud Boys announced a march in Portland, anti-fascists came out in droves, and rather than being, you know, protected by the police, were attacked by the police. There was a lot of perception of, just imbalance in the way that event was handled, and that's been echoed in other places across the country too. So I guess, what do you have to say regarding the role of the state in combating fascism and protecting average citizens from these kind of street level folks?
That's right. It's mixed, and oftentimes we have seen things like what we saw in that particular instance in Portland, where the police seem to be more on the side of the fascists than on the side of the people protesting the fascists. It just really goes back to this not being fundamentally a problem about crime. These are people that are trying to normalize themselves. They're trying to take political power, and they're willing to try a number of means to do that. And if they find that law enforcement are going to crack down on them for certain methods, then they'll try others, whether that's taking over political parties or taking over culture. So their goal is power. And in fact, they have a certain implicit respect, I think, for the police, and in some cases have infiltrated police departments because they are fundamentally authoritarians. And the police know that. And I think there's, police departments are made up of individuals with many different views on things. But I think they also sometimes at the structural level understand that one side is authoritarian and one side is anti-authoritarian, and that impacts their approach to the matter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I appreciate your focus on building community as the way to solve this, because like you said, it's so complex. It's got roots, deep roots, through history globally, not just in this country. Gotta all dig together, I guess, is the way to continue that metaphor.
Yes.
If people want to know more, particularly from like an academic perspective, where can they find out more about both your work, but also some people that you're influenced by? Do you have like a short reading and resource list to share?
Yeah, a lot of my work at this point has been through public speaking. I'm going to publish some things soon on this topic. One of the, I'm wearing a lot of different hats in the community, but one of my hats is that I'm involved in the Institute for Hate Studies at Gonzaga University. And we are sponsoring a conference in April. Of course, I'm just speaking as myself here, but I'm very excited about that work and the journal that they have and the research that they do. At the national level, you also have the Southern Poverty Law Center, which just does impeccable research. You can look up all different kinds of people from, you know, our local state rep, Matt Shea, to Identity Europa on their website. And Political Research Associates is one that's a little less known, but they do just wonderful research if you look up their website. And they're also happy to talk to people directly if you have particular questions. I've found them very helpful. There's a wonderful book as well by Shane Burley, who's a journalist out of Portland. And if you want a kind of quick book introduction, I would check out his book on fascism, Fascism Today, What It Is and How to End It. And then finally, there are some really nice documentaries if you just want to watch some stuff online. On Netflix, there's a documentary called White Right that focuses more on the mentality and psychology of the people within these movements. And then there's a kind of more hardcore, more activist-oriented kind of documentary out by ProPublica, which is really good, looking at how Charlottesville developed and the different organizations and people that were involved in Charlottesville. And I believe that's just called Charlottesville. So if you look online, or maybe Documenting Hate, Charlottesville. So there's a lot of really good resources out there, and I would really encourage people to reach out and talk to people and not feel like you have to do this as an individual, because there are so many people out there doing this work. So contacting organizations and people that do this work is really positive.
Great. Well, thank you so much for talking with me today. I feel like we could just continue to learn from you for multiple hours.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Taylor.
Yeah. Have a good...
I love your show.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. Thanks for being my first guest for the return.
Thank you.
All right. If you're just joining us, listening in at the end of the hour here, that was Dr. Joan Braun talking with me, Taylor, host of Praxis on Saturday, about fascism, what it is, what it looks like around here, how to fight it, most importantly. So, I'm really, really thankful that she was willing to be my first guest of the return of the show. So, let's see, before we wrap up and send you into the next hour, I will let you know that I have a lot of really great shows planned coming up through September and October. But again, if you have ideas, if you have questions, please do email me at praxis@kyrs.org, P-R-A-X-I-S. And next week, I'm going to be talking with Paul Kivel, who's an author working a lot on issues around anti-racism, but also working more recently on the issue of Christian dominance in our culture and what that looks like. I'm interviewing him in honor of Vice President Mike Pence's arrival in Spokane next Tuesday, October 2nd. So he's coming as well. So in his honor, we're going to talk about the influence of Christian conservatism in our culture at large. So make sure to tune in for that. Again, you can find the podcast online, both at kyrs.org and at soundcloud.com/praxisradio. Thanks so much for listening. I'll be back next Monday at 4:00.